This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Pianist Chick Corea and vibraphonist Gary Burton right here playing this little piece. It's an improv, right? Doesn't have much of a tune that your brain can make out. Doesn't make much sense, but there is, of course, more order to it than just random notes. So how does our brain make sense of this music? My next guest studies jazz fMRIs. No, that's not the name of a jazz radio station. He studies the brain scans of jazz musicians to figure out how creativity works. His latest study was published this week in the journal PLOS1. Charles Lim is associate professor of otolaryngology, head and neck surgery, and a faculty member at the Peabody Conservatory of Music. That's at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore, Maryland. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Now, you looked specifically at jazz musicians. What makes them different from other musicians?
So I think jazz is known really for the unique ability of the musicians to improvise. So music that they've never played before, that they're never going to play again, coming spontaneously off the top of their heads at a really high, sophisticated level. So in a way, it's like looking at creativity, capturing it in a bottle.
Hmm. And you actually, now this is, describe this setup you used to actually study how improvisation is recorded in your brain. You actually took sort of a keyboard you concocted and brought it into a brain scanner with you?
That's exactly right. An fMRI machine is not the most user-friendly place to play jazz because it's a big magnet. It's really tight. You have to lie down, so you can't go in there with a tube or something like that and just start honking away. So we had to design a sort of plastic piano keyboard that would fit inside the fMRI scanner and still be audible to the musician and sort of feel and sound like a piano. And we were able to do that. It took about 2 years to make the setup work. And then once we actually had the machinery working, we could bring in some jazz musicians and have them start playing.
Mm-hmm. And let's listen to some of that jazz in the scanner, what it sounds like. First, I'm going to play the melody of musicians that were improvising. Let's play that. Now that's the piece that they were going to improvise off of. So we heard that sounds like a very nice little piece, right? Now we're going to hear a piece of what they did, how they improvised off of that. Now, Dr. Lim, as we listen to that, what did you find out from the scans that you saw from those pieces playing?
So the purpose of this experiment was to really understand this idea of musical conversation. So I've long wondered when musicians are communicating with one another, they're doing it without words. They're not using traditional concepts of language to have this communication, yet clearly there's a very significant, robust communication that's taking place. And so what I wanted to see here was what happens in the brains when musicians have this, what we call musical conversation. And so the experiment was what we just heard, two musicians sort of taking turns trading fours back and forth, which is a common jazz sort of convention that's done in music quite frequently. And so what we found was that when musicians engage in this kind of musical conversation, that language areas of the brain responsible for syntax are very active, robustly active in comparison to a memorized exchange. But also, we found that there was a lack of activity, or what we call deactivation, in areas of the brain that are linked to what's called semantic cognition, or the meaning of words. And this, I think, is kind of an interesting idea when you think of what music means.
Tell us about that a little more. Explain that difference a little bit more for us.
Sure. So in language, we use words very specifically to have a precise meaning. So for example, you can tell somebody in a few words to meet you for lunch at noon somewhere. But in music, you know, I could play saxophone all day long, but no one's going to understand that I'm asking them to meet me for lunch at noon. Mm-hmm. And so there's a difference in the purpose and the goals of the communication, sort of what they're better at doing. So language is very good for conveying meaning. Music is very good for conveying emotional impact and for sort of sharing emotion between two individuals, but the meaning is a little bit less precise. And so we saw that implemented in the brain.
Did you see any emotion you know, because if people love the music or like playing the music, would that part light up too?
Somewhat, yeah. So what we saw in general with these creativity studies is that when musicians start improvising, that areas of the brain that are part of the limbic system, so areas such as the amygdala that are linked to aversion, are sort of suppressed during this process. And so it might be that improvisation is this kind of rewarding experience that causes what we call deactivation in some of these limbic areas.
Mm-hmm. So what are you actually trying to study here when you do these, when you took these these keyboards into the brain scanner with you?
Well, I think there are several goals of this kind of research. The first is this idea that traditionally scientists have shied away from the arts, meaning that it's kind of been viewed as off limits or maybe too difficult or too intractable to study. Now, meanwhile, you know, artistic behavior has been a cornerstone of human civilization forever. And I think, you know, personally, that by looking at artists, we can really understand how it is that humans not only generate new ideas, but also innovate. And so what I'm trying to understand is how this actually happens in the brain. And I'm using jazz and music in general as kind of a tool to tap into this larger process of creativity, which is the watching the brain as it comes up with a new idea.
Do you think if you did not use music and you used math or some other form of study, that you could see the same thing happening, the brain innovating in the same areas?
I think we might see similar findings, but they would also be different in many important respects. I think the music has a very particular quality to it, which is very good at enabling what's called a flow state, or this kind of sort of altered state of mind or consciousness where musical ideas are flowing very easily. It's kind of like getting into the zone or getting into the groove. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure there's a sort of zone or a groove associated with math, but it's not probably the very same thing that's associated with a creative flow state.
Might maybe painting a picture or drawing something.
Exactly.
Closer, right? I have to find out how you talked somebody into letting you bring a keyboard into an fMRI machine.
Yeah, it was interesting. So literally, I would say for the first year and a half of my trying to get this thing to work, I got a lot of strange looks down at the fMRI center. This was at the National Institutes of Health back then. But, you know, after a while, the idea started to kind of get a bit of a following. And when we got it to work, there was really sort of an excitement about the idea of using the tool now to study high-level musicians and also possibly children or amateur musicians. I mean, I think people saw that there was a lot of potential that just a simple piano keyboard could bring in terms of sort of unlocking the secrets of some of the musical brain.
Because I understand you had used rappers too, right?
That's right. So that was another study where once we had looked at jazz, I wanted to look at other sort of analogous flow states. And I think freestyle rappers, if you're familiar with that, it's a remarkable activity where rappers can generate just amazing amounts of material off the top of their head and such clever use of language and rhymes and rhythm. And so because I live in Baltimore and there's a pretty active underground hip-hop scene here, I started kind of getting familiar with some of the rappers and eventually convinced some of them to come to the scanner where we essentially did a similar experiment using the brain scanner to watch their brains while they freestyled.
And so where do you go from here?
I have a lot of directions that we want to move into. So I think that there are a couple of kind of profound questions that this kind of research raises. And one is the idea of, how do we acquire creativity? You know, so there's this notion that you have 10,000 hours that you have to kind of train in something. But what about when you're a child? I mean, we know that children are very creative. What if we were to look at the brains of children doing creative tasks? How does that differ than an adult? Likewise, how does the brain of an adult who's learning something new, maybe you're taking up a musical instrument at the age of 30 or 40, how does that differ from an expert musician trying to do a similar task or a similar creative task?
All right. Then, good luck to you. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you very much for having me. Appreciate it.
Charles Lim, Associate Professor of Otolaryngology, Head and Neck Surgery, and he's a faculty member at the Peabody Conservatory of Music at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore.